Support comes from ARC Industries, providing business solutions to Columbus's industrial, retail, and commercial markets, and helping people with disabilities find meaningful work. ARC Industries, dedicated to the success of its customers, employees, and community. ARC Industries is online at arcind.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The National Labor Relations Board has said that Northwestern University football players have the right to form college sports' first labor union. Although the decision affects only private school athletics, the ripple effect through college sports was felt immediately. Every sports columnist, the NCAA, former college players, and many other interested parties weighed in on this latest iteration of a conversation that began years ago when the economics of big-time college sports started to change the game. NCAA President Mark Emmert predicted in an interview last weekend that the National Labor Relations Board decision will go to the U.S. Supreme Court. He called it a fundamental change. Coming up, we'll hear from a scholar of big-time sports and get his take on the NLRB decision. Joining us now is the Ohio State University Director of Athletics, Gene Smith. Welcome back to the show.
Well, it's good to be here, Ann. Thank you.
You were in the news recently yourself for a pay-related issue. The Associated Press reported that when OSU student Logan Stieber won the 141-pound wrestling NCAA championship a few weeks ago, his success triggered a bonus in your contract. You pick up that same bonus of $18,000 every time an OSU athlete wins an individual national title in sports like wrestling, swimming, fencing, and that sort of thing. Now, your deal is par for the business. It's not the most lucrative, actually, by a long shot. But some critics suggest that those sorts of deals are part of the problem that the millions Ohio State rakes in from football and basketball don't all go to support other sports, like people are often told, that they go to support the coaches and administrators like you, and that that's part of the problem when we talk about player rights and fairness.
Yeah, you know, it's a deep issue, Ann, and basically my contract is kind of an old model. Started in the 80s. We're a largely incentive-driven environment in athletics, and where our scoreboard is kept in the media, you keep it, as well as other people. So we're largely incentive-based oriented. And it started in the late 80s when the market for coaches and athletic directors started to change, and the base salary started to grow. So institutions looked for other ways to try and compensate us for what we do and keep us paid consistent with what the market is. And so they came up with a lot of different incentives. And so that's probably something that needs to change over time. It's kind of like what we're dealing with some of the NCAA rules that need to change to provide some more benefits to student athletes. So my contract is consistent with what many other athletic directors have, but it probably should change over time.
You're listening
just for a perception point of view.
Yeah, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Gene Smith, OSU Director of Athletics. We're talking about his contract in the context of the larger question about how players are compensated and whether they should be compensated, given the recent National Labor Relations Board ruling for Northwestern University giving the football players the rights to form a union. It wasn't for pay. Pay wasn't the issue. There are a lot of larger issues involved in this. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. The idea of image, you said, if for no other reason, the perception should be a reason. People were really shocked when they heard about that that bonus that you get. How much do you think people thoroughly understand how college sports, particularly
Most people don't understand college athletics at all. They don't. And so,
well, they watch the game every Saturday.
That's it. That's
Saturday,
all you
though.
See. So let's talk about the issue. The broader issue is we institutions like ours, there's 351 Division I schools, there's five big-time conferences, the SEC, the Big Ten, the Pac-12, the ACC, and I'm forgetting that there's a fifth. So there's 65 schools in that group out of the 351. Those 65 schools generate a great deal of money.
Most of it.
Yes. And so the reality is the revenue that we generate, a great deal of it gets back to the student athlete. A significant majority gets back to the student athlete. Here at Ohio State, we have 36 sports. And out of our $139 million budget that we generate in revenue, 32 million goes back to the institution. So then you take that down, and so you take a full ride scholar athlete, a student athlete that's on a full ride scholarship, room, boards, book, and tuition. Let's just say they're in state. It's $11,000 stipend they get. So every 2 weeks they get an $800 check
for
board, for room and board.
Okay.
So when you're on campus in your freshman year, you don't get that check because we're paying directly to housing. But when you move off, you get that $11,000 throughout the year, $800 every other week. Now, if you're a Pell student athlete, you're financially needy by federal government standards, you get $5,600 on top of that. So you get that spread out over two semesters. Okay? So, but the issue is not the money like that that's directly in that way. The issue is our scholarship model is old. It's kind of like my contract is an old model. The scholarship model is old because we do not provide anything above and beyond the direct expenses. We do not provide cost of attendance. If we go and recruit a talented violinist, we offer them a full ride scholarship, which is room, board, books, and tuition, plus whatever the institution defines as cost of attendance. Here at Ohio State, it's about $3,700, $3,800. And that takes into consideration laundry costs, personal care, travel to and home from here at home X number of times a year, so it's cost of attendance. At Stanford, it's probably higher because you're on the West Coast in Palo Alto. I think it's like $6,700 at Stanford. So what we need to do is change that scholarship model.
How would you change the model?
Well, it's legislation. So,
but I mean, in what way? Is it the model, or are you talking about changing the amounts?
Both. So you change the model, so your scholarship now becomes a base scholarship plus cost of attendance. So that changes the model to include cost of attendance, which changes the amount. Okay. So now, one of the pieces of legislation that's being considered is to go up to $2,000 in cost of attendance. So now on top of everything else you're getting another $2,000. So that's one of the issues that's being discussed nationally. And then there's a lot of other issues. For example, health care. We cannot provide health care insurance for student athletes. However, at Ohio State, if you get injured, say, in your senior year, you have surgery, and you leave for 2 years and go work on the West Coast, and you have another surgery as a result of that injury, we pay for it. We'll work with you to pay for it. But a lot of schools don't do that.
Well, okay, we know a lot more about the damage that can come from the high-impact sports like football.
Yeah, same with gymnastics.
A lot more gymnastics, any of them.
Any of them.
Right. Joint, long-term joint problems, anything like that. What about that long-term thing? Because most, regardless of how many it seems, most of the players don't go on to these multi-million dollar careers of fame and fortune. Most of them just hopefully finish college.
Right.
Many don't still.
Well, that's not really true.
It's getting better.
That's not really true.
It's getting better.
Yeah.
And they don't go out and make most of them don't go out and make the kind of money that attracts them or may attract them to the sport in the first place. Mm-hmm. Who takes care of them long term?
Well, it depends. Like at Ohio State, if they have an injury that they incurred here, then when they have recurring issues with as a result of that injury here, we take care of them. Now, again, there's 351 Division I schools. Everybody doesn't do that. Your top schools that generate revenue like we do, we have programs in place. Another example to the graduation point is we have a degree completion program. So when a student athlete leaves early, they're maybe 24 credit hours short, and they want to complete their degree, they come back, we pay for it.
Even though they've gone off to the MBA.
Doesn't matter. Greg
NFL.
Oden, Michael Conley, all those guys, when they come back to school, Michael Redd just retired. You know, he's a multimillionaire, but we still pay for his tuition to complete his degree. A lot of schools don't do that. So what the Cane Culture and the union initiative is trying to do is get everybody to do those type of things. And so there's a lot of schools that already do what they're talking about.
Two-time Heisman Trophy winner and OSU Buckeye, Archie Griffin, said that he believes student-athletes should be paid at least the full cost of attendance.
That's right.
Is that what you're talking
That's
about?
That's what I'm talking about. So what he's not saying is paid. He's not talking about an employer-employee relationship. He's talking about take it to the cost of attendance where they get more money. So if I start playing, and actually this is what Cane Culture is, they're not interested in getting paid. So if I turn it into an employer-employee relationship, that changes the whole dynamic where I'm giving you an employer-employee check. You get taxed on everything. Your whole relationship changes because now your accountability is totally different. So what he's taught, what Archie's talking about, and I agree with, is we have to change the scholarship model where there's cost of attendance, where the student athletes get more money.
I was at a St. Patrick's Day party where a competitive amateur Irish dancer performed while we passed the hat to raise money to send her to a national competition. A neighborhood, a community can't do the same for, say, an OSU basketball player who isn't on full scholarship, who needs extra money to go to school.
That's right.
Or they can't even do it to raise money to send his parents play at a championship game.
That's right.
What is the magic of amateur in college athletics, and why is there those kind of rules?
It was so back in the day, to your example, in the 70s and 80s, it used to be that certain environments, and we'll use Las Vegas, for example, certain environments, you get a student athlete a job, and they stand around and watch the grass grow, or they would park cars at the Caesar's Palace and get paid $5,000 for parking cars. So it really goes back to some competitive equity issues and when you're looking at the example that you gave. You know, the big issue here that we have to look at is in athletics, where do we have issues where we can provide student athletes more benefits? Perfect example is in lacrosse, you know, football. I was on a panel yesterday with Corey Lindsley, our former starting center, and he's 100% right. We have walk-on student athletes that we can't provide training table meals to. That's crazy. That's an old rule that prohibits that, so we need to lift that rule so we can help those student athletes. The piece that's being missed, though, is what we currently do, and that's what's so challenging about this debate. People are forgetting what we currently do. So you're a recruited athlete, you get a full-ride scholarship. First of all, that school full-ride scholarship is extremely valuable. I mean, that's extremely valuable. We do need to add cost of attendance, but you can't forget that value. Plus, we surround you with experts to help you develop that the other student population doesn't get. So plus, we have a career development program and a job placement program that's specifically people want to interview our athletes because of what they learn in group dynamics. So we have a lot of student athletes that get jobs because they were athletes. And so
Not because they were athletes.
Mm-hmm. Because of what you learn as an athlete, discipline, time management, the ability to deal with adversity. We do financial literacy programs. I mean, there's a lot of different life skills things that we teach that a general student in a non-team environment don't get an opportunity to learn. So there's great things we do, but we need to improve on a lot of the things we do relative to financial resources for those who need it. Corey Lindsay yesterday said it really well in the panel I was on. He said, you know what? I was fine. He said, my parents bought me a car. You know, my issue wasn't money. Okay. So but the issue is there's a group of student athletes who, and I've seen it in my 30 years, who maybe Pell eligible, get their full ride scholarship, but they may send half of their money home because their sisters and brothers need it. Mm-hmm. So those are the ones that we really have to target and make sure we help.
My guest is Gene Smith, OSU Director of Athletics. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Dan Fisher. The National Labor Relations Board has said that Northwestern University football players have the right to form College Sports First Labor Union. The decision affects only private school athletics, and it's not about money, but the ripple effect through college sports was felt immediately. Every sports columnist, the NCAA, former college players, many other interested parties weighed in on this latest chapter of a conversation that began years ago when the economics of big-time college sports started to change the game. I've been talking with Gene Smith, Ohio State University Director of Athletics, and we've been talking about how the models have not changed with the times. Joining us now by phone is Professor of Economics and Law at Duke University and author of Big Time Sports in American Universities, Charles Klotfelter. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot.
Author and sports journalist John Feinstein wrote this week about several issues around revolving around the NLRB ruling, including the idea that underperforming athletes could be fired or traded. But an NCAA scholarship is guaranteed only for 1 year. Can you talk about that, Gene Smith, real quickly, about what happens? There's supposedly some kind of protection in college sports that you don't get in professional sports. John Feinstein saying that's not really true.
Yeah, every scholarship is 1 year renewable. However, there was a piece of legislation that was passed that makes it permissive to provide multi-year scholarships. And some schools, some sports provide 2 year, 3 year, 4 year scholarships. So you get that commitment. It comes down to the philosophy of the athletic department that you reside in. So for here at Ohio State, you retain your scholarship for that 4 years out of the five that you're here if necessary, unless you violate a student code of conduct or you have other discipline problems, behavioral problems that require us to dismiss you from the program. If a student athlete comes here and for some reason athletically they don't pan out, then that's not the student athlete's fault. So they get to retain their scholarship. But a lot of schools do not renew scholarships because of athletic performance, and I just think that that's wrong.
Charles Klotfelter, how much is that sense of security a part of this conversation?
I think it is part of it. If every university were to be as tolerant and progressive as Ohio State, it would probably be less of a problem. But the issue remains that the university could decide, let's say another university could decide, that we don't want to guarantee the 4 years and we want to hold to the 1 year probation, basically. And it gives the coaches a tremendous amount of, influence over their players.
Power.
Charles is right. Yeah. That's one of the issues in running off kids, and it's wrong. And so he's 100% right. The coach is put in a position where, okay, this student-athlete didn't pan out like I thought. I got to win, so I'm going to run him off and go recruit somebody else. So the kids, you know, they don't have this sense of security that they're always going to have that scholarship unless they perform.
Charles Klotfelter, correct me if I'm wrong, but a student athlete can't get an agent or somebody to help them find the right school. They have to rely on their own resources, their own research, of course their parents and that sort of thing. Is that right?
We have lawyers at the Duke Law School who understand all this. I'm not a lawyer. My understanding is that that's correct, that they are really not able to have contact with a professional agent until the 11th hour. So one thing that Duke does, and probably Ohio State does it as well, is there are seminars set up for athletes by law professors that say this is what's going to happen, and mm-hmm. that's a good thing.
When you say the 11th hour, you mean the 11th hour of their college career.
That's right. When they are just on the verge of going pro, they really haven't had the ability to have an agent talk to them. And you could think of that, well, this is for their protection, but this is one of the several respects in which people have said that college athletes don't have the same kind of, legal rights that most people would have. And this is This is probably one of the issues that's in the mix.
That's true. And actually, and there's an effort to go through a change in the governance structure of the NCAA, and it probably will happen, probably voted on in August. And one of the concepts is exactly this. How do we allow agents to work with our student athletes earlier in the process for those who think they can go pro? Now, I think your other question, though, was maybe about the high school kids.
How to get to college.
There's a number of sports where families do have advisors. So ice hockey is one of the ones where families would go and seek some advisor, not an agent,
right,
where they sign a contract, but some advisor that's familiar with ice hockey and college rules. Baseball has that as well. So different sports, they have that. So, and some of the sophisticated families,
right,
use other people to help them with that process. Now, keep in mind, Ann, in some of our sports, these kids are committing when they're 14 years old. So, you know, I saw that look on your face. It's the dynamic.
I thought it was always like a high school senior sort of thing.
We always talk about football and basketball,
yeah,
which is typically your case. You're right. High school seniors, juniors. But
they wait.
And soccer and volleyball and these other sports and gymnastics, they're committing where they're 13, 14 years old sometimes. And so that's one of our challenges as well.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Gene Smith, OSU's athletic director, and also Charles Klotfelter. He teaches economics and law at Duke University. He's the author of Big Time Sports in American Universities. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have a comment from the web. They say students get scholarships and better, I guess it's athletics, athletes get scholarships and better housing and meal plans than other students on campus. They also have access to free tutors. They are given more advantages than most students on campus. If the students don't feel like the school is giving them enough, maybe they should quit the team and try to pay their own way through school like most people have to do. I suppose then they would realize just how good they have it. Gene Smith, do you think, what do you make of that comment about student athletes?
Well, that's a standard perception out there among athletes, and there is some truth to that, that student athletes have benefits that the general student population don't have. And so the things we're talking about and that the Kane culture and the union are driving for are the right things. But we always forget about the great things that our student athletes have in place. I'm a big believer. If a student athlete believes they want to be pro and they're not committed to academics, then go pro. Just leave. But the reality is, while they're here, they get great support to help them develop, to help them mature in a fast way and prepare them for life. There's all types of life skills programs for student athletes that are mandatory that other students don't have access to on a consistent basis. So I wouldn't say they're pampered, but I would say they have resources that at their disposal that other students just don't have.
And Charles Klotfelter, the thing is that that's not necessarily the case everywhere.
The problem with saying, well, they could just go somewhere else, is that they can't. And I guess from the standpoint of a professor looking at this, one thing you're struck by is that, especially the big-time sports, basketball, men's basketball, and football, the market is doing wonders by paying everybody their market wage. Everybody is able to make decisions independently as we would in any market, except for one group, and that is the students who are on these teams. And the NCAA, well, universities, let's say who it is, universities have gathered together in a group called the NCAA, and they've done something that in any other market we would call a cartel, and in fact it would be against the law. According to a law in 1890 passed, the Sherman Antitrust Act, you can't do this in the market for baby formula or tires. But here it's done. That is, the people that are hiring these young people have gotten together and said, we're going to make a deal that we're not going to pay them anything more than this tuition and fees, which is not nothing, but these players don't have the same rights in the market that the coaches do, the athletic directors do, the universities do. And so that is really a big distinction. It's just you can't say, well, I'm going to go to some other school because the other school is also part of the same cartel. So that's the thing that is really distinctive about this situation as seen by an economist.
Another thing a student athlete can't do is say, I'm going to go to another school and play there next year. You have to take a year off.
Well, in some sports, right. in football,
why
you have to sit
that?
Out. Well, it's recruiting. So, you know, if we want to go and attract a top quarterback from, you know, Stanford, who played last year, he's playing at Stanford, and, you know, we go recruit the kid at Stanford to transfer to Ohio State. So there's some competitive equity issues there that are trying to be balanced. But Charles is right. The reality is the rules that are in place now that were voted on by, you know, probably 200-something schools as opposed to 351 are old. There's the rules from the 70s, rules from the 80s, and the association, the schools that make up the NCAA, the association hasn't stayed up with the times. And that's why you have now the top five conferences are trying to collaborate and come up with a new governance structure for at least the top 65 schools, where the financial wherewithal provides you an opportunity to address some of these issues, healthcare, degree completion programs, cost of attendance, things of that nature. We're not able to do some of the things that the students would like us to be able to do. And so the 65 have been working over a year now to try and come up with this new governance model that I think will get voted on in August, and we'll be able to address some of these issues.
Brian in Upper Arlington, you're on in the air. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Ann. This is a great topic. I think it's very poignant. I was listening earlier when you and Gene were speaking about, you know, that we're breaking it down as far as what students are basically given as far as stipends and how books and stuff are paid for. But no one really addressed the ultimate issue that a lot of people are thinking about. And there's this argument from the NCAA that paying players is so immoral and it would ruin this fiber of amateurism. And no one's really addressing that issue. We've talked about compensation, especially like medical stuff, and that's great. But at the end of the day, people want to know, why can't we pay athletes? And, we have these scandals that OSU has had that in the recent years of, you know, players being paid for things. Everyone's making money, and it comes down to indentured servitude, really, is what I see it. Everyone is making a lot of money, and that issue has not been addressed. You know, Gene Smith, makes a decent amount of money. We have, obviously, Tressel and now Urban Meyer making these millions of dollars and all these perks that are on top of, you know, their skills. But we're talking about a full-time job that these students do when you taken to practice and workout and volunteer hours they're required to do, meetings and things like that, and yet they're paid pittance for what they do, and no one is talking about the payment issue, the actual doling out of a salary of some sort to these students.
Yeah,
that's a very good one.
What is the magic of
the amateurism?
Well,
I think you have to look at, and that's well said, I think you have to look at what is the end goal? The end goal, in my view, is to get student athletes more financial resources. And I think the challenge is, if we move to maybe we're talking semantics, if we move to a pay model where you, and I would be interested in Charles's perspective, where you have an employer-employee relationship, mm-hmm. where they are actually getting a paycheck. Now, in the state of Ohio, you can't do that. It's illegal. But if you did that, what does that mean? What does that look like?
As opposed to the kid who works at the cafeteria.
I think a lot of this is what is the issue? I know, for example, that many of our student athletes need more money. And I'm looking at trying to promote a model to get them more money that does not turn them into an employer-employee relationship. Because that creates different problems in different states. It creates different tax issues, workers' compensation. So there's a lot of different issues there. But the bottom line is, to the caller's point, is we need to get more money to the athletes. Now, how do you actually do that is the issue. So I'm not a proponent of turning them into employees where you actually pay them a paycheck. I'm more interested in trying to find ways to give them more money in a different model. And I'd be interested in Charles's perspective.
Charles Klatfelter, what are the big hurdles in terms of that employee-employer relationship?
Oh, there are thousands of them. once you open that onion, then you're going to find a lot of things. But I guess I would come back to I like the sympathy that that Gene Smith is showing toward these athletes, and that ought to guide us to find something. It just when you look at the situation now, and you see, especially for the star athletes, they are bringing their universities. In some cases, it's been estimated that the average eventual pro pick in football brings his university while he's still a student over $500,000 every year he plays. And in basketball, this is called a marginal revenue product. This is the extra revenue they bring. In basketball, it's over $1 million. Now, and these universities, like my university, we're selling jerseys, and some of the jerseys have a number on them that correspond to some player. And of course, the other issues like using likenesses. Well, when these universities are profiting from this and the students aren't getting anything, then you just can't look at this and say, that's fair. And so I think there's got to be, there are a lot of smart people involved with this. Surely they can work out some way to compensate the stars at least. And in addition, do the things that Gene Smith is talking about in terms of extra expenditures and health. But for the stars, figure out some way to put something aside so when they graduate, they get something. So I don't think you have to be tied to an employee relationship in the formal sense.
A trust fund type of thing where mm-hmm. they are getting mm-hmm. a cut of that's been brought up many times, particularly for players who don't go on to the major leagues of whatever sport they're in, and yet their image is still put out there and used by the universities.
Yeah, I mean, it gets down, and Charles is right, there's a lot of smart people that have figured this out, and I think it will. I think the challenge is where, the new governance structure that's going to ultimately be in place will allow us to do that. The structure we're currently in does not allow us to do that.
Why?
Well, there's 351 schools. All of us are really only talking about a certain number of schools that this is an issue with. And the reality is what we're talking about are the big schools. With all due respect, the Middle Tennessee State, you're not talking about the same issues. But they vote on all the legislation that is in place.
And it affects them differently.
That's right. They're part of the association, and that's the challenge. For years, since 1961, with Division I, if you played basketball, you were a Division I institution, and if you met certain other criteria. So that's grown to the current size of 351 schools. So if we create a piece of legislation, like the cost of attendance model, is going to get voted down because a large majority of those schools can't afford it.
Okay.
So the reality is we have to come up with a model that allows those five conferences, those 65 schools who have the financial wherewithal to do what we're talking about doing
for themselves,
to be able to legislate those things for themselves, for their student athletes. Then it'd be permissive for the other schools if they're a basketball playing school, don't have big football, so their numbers aren't as big, they might be able to do those things. But the 65-day, we need to come up with a way to get more resources back to the kids.
Gene Smith, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks, Charles.
Gene Smith, he's Ohio State University Director of Athletics. Charles Klatfelter, author of Big Time Sports in American Universities, will stay with us. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. The National Labor Relations Board has said that Northwestern University football players have the right to form College Sports First Labor Union. Although the decision affects only private school athletics, the ripple effect through college sports was felt immediately. Still with us is professor of economics and law at Duke University and author of Big Time Sports in American Universities, Charles Klotfelter. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. The NLRB ruling affected only Northwestern and isn't applicable to public colleges and universities, which are state-managed. Could this, though, bring about a patchwork quilt of players' rights? Gene Smith was talking about the Big 65 changing, you know, things with them, but what about the rest of them out there?
Well, there are so many variables out there, I would hesitate to make any kind of prediction. The world is always a lot more interesting than you think it might be. But the patchwork, I like that idea. I think that there are several things in play right now that have the potential of shaking things up a little bit. Gene Smith was talking about a group of 60-some-odd universities getting together and making their own rules, but if those rules gave the athletes a little bit more money here and there, it's the same principle is still going to be around, and that is that the players really don't have the kind of rights that an employee would, or in fact, in a lot of cases, the players are much more constrained than their fellow students. A player cannot, for example, put a piece of tape over the swoosh on his uniform because there's a contract which is paying somebody money that's prohibiting that, and the player can't do it. The player can't write on his face something like Psalms 23:1 because there's a rule against that. Any other student at Duke University or Ohio State, they could write Psalm 23:1 on their face, but not a player because of the NCAA rules. So there's a number of respects in which these students don't get treated the same way as others, and they're certainly not getting treated the same way as the coaches in terms of compensation.
Jonathan in Columbus, you're on the air with Charles Klotfelter, author of Big Time Sports in American Universities. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi. My question is, given this is a cartel amongst the NCAA and the universities that are restricting the employment rights of these athletes, what would happen to a university or more recently, say, a conference like the ACC if the ACC just said, okay, we're going to treat this as free market, we're going to start playing players, we're going to use a more free market type system, NCAA, you do what you want to do. What would happen if a conference decided to do that?
It'd take a lawyer to tell you all the ramifications, but my guess is that the NCAA would say, well, our members can't play against those ACC teams because they're professionals, so every single game that is scheduled against an ACC opponent would get canceled.
Yeah, except now, if all 65 of these teams, these big teams, do this, the NCAA would have to follow, wouldn't they?
Well, all I know is if one conference decided it wanted to radically change this model, it would become the black sheep right away, and the NCAA or whatever this new organization has would certainly prohibit its teams from playing these players that are now getting paid.
Jonathan, thanks a lot for your call. Joan in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Ann. I have always wondered why the universities don't put together an academic curriculum to, just like, you know, Fisher College of Business, you go through business school, you get interns, you learn about, you know, your career in business. Why don't the universities have a curriculum for professional sports?
They, and some universities do have something that goes in that direction. So I know a university that is much beloved in Columbus, called the University of Michigan, has a kinesiology major, and there could be something at Ohio State as well like that. So some of the large state universities do have either, they could be leisure studies, they could be physical education, and of course there's business majors as well. So if one wanted to design a major that would prepare somebody for being an NFL player, of course the numbers are not going to be that great. One could do it, but no university has done exactly that. But there are things that approach that.
Joan, thanks for the call. I think that ultimately the idea of having a degree in professional sports, it would have to be, it wouldn't be a degree preparing you as an individual to compete in professional sports, because there wouldn't be enough demand, I would think.
I think it might also run into other objections. The people that approve curricula and majors at the university might look at that and say, is this really something that coheres as a discipline that we're going to be able to justify to the accreditation in agencies or our fellow scholars? Is this something that we're going to be proud of? And so that would be another hurdle to jump through.
Gene Smith was talking about changes among the Big 65. Is there anything, given your study of the situation, that can push the NCAA itself to begin a study of the rights of players?
I don't want to be uncharitable, but if one looks at the history of the NCAA, again, this is a collection of universities like Ohio State and like my university, Duke. Their attitude about paying has been extreme, and also things like the recognition of the employer-employee type of relationship. They have been very defensive. And in fact, the term student athlete was invented by a fellow named Walter Byers, who was head of the NCAA. And the idea behind the term student athlete is that your football player is identical to your wrestling participant, to your rowing participant, and to your lacrosse player. That is, they are all the same group. And this works for the NCAA in putting them all under the same umbrella. But in fact, the players that participate in these revenue sports are really doing something in a different activity. And if I were just take another minute to say, if I were giving a lecture on what is the meaning of college athletics, I'd say there's really two different meanings. One meaning is that we have students who are on teams. They learn things about discipline, about hard work. They learn how to win gracefully and lose gracefully. These are things that educators like me would say, yes, we ought to put that as part of a undergraduate curriculum. That is part of the education. And then the other definition of college athletics is a commercial enterprise that just happens to be produced by universities, either nonprofit or public. And there's really very little educational content. There's just a teeny amount, but most of it is all about a commercial activity, which is fun to look at and part of our traditions and culture, but it's not educational. So that if we would start thinking about these as two different things, then we could get used to saying, well, there ought to be some different rules for these things that are bringing in so much money. But the NCAA has steadfastly tried to say they're all the same.
Email from Jan. She writes, my kids, grandkids have been taught that it takes a team to win or lose a game. So I believe just rewarding the stars in after college is unfair to the rest of the supporting team members. What do you make of that, Charles Klotfelter? I mean, that's the way it happens in professional.
Well, I'm an economist, so, you know, it's anybody can justify differences in pay. You know, that's what we do. And so I look at the people that work for the Duke University basketball program. One of them makes in excess of $5 million a year. A lot of them make around $30,000. So is that unfair? Well, the market says this is what we do. So that if you take that same idea and apply it to whatever comes out, well, it's going to be unfair in some sense, but it would also, in another sense, be more equitable because at the moment, all of those players, including the really good ones, are constrained. Their pay is limited by this agreement.
An email from Becky, she writes, so if the movement to unionize is supposedly not about money, what exactly do these athletes want to come as a result of having a union? Also, what are the implications for other private schools like Northwestern? Let's take the first question. They don't want to be paid. That's not the point. But what are the things that they do want a voice in?
They say they don't want to get paid, and I think that's true. I think that's, again, the pay thing is, it's going to be for a small number. So I really believe that the issues are more, what happens if I get injured? Right now there's no guarantee that that Northwestern University is going to take care of me. I may have an extensive recuperation period. It's nothing that obligates Northwestern University to take care of me. And so that would be one thing. The second thing might be, are you nickeling and diming me and not letting me just get some minimal things like an extra coat or going home another time? Those are things that Gene Smith was talking about. And again, a union would allow discussions to occur about that. But this is really uncharted territory to have an idea that undergraduate students are part of a union is it's kind of a big pill to take, and it's hard to know exactly how it's going to play out.
And we're probably far from knowing exactly that. And real quickly, we only have about 30 seconds, but just the implications for other private schools. I mean, is this like a domino effect, or do you think people most likely will wait and find out what happens with Northwestern?
I think everybody's going to wait and hope that nothing happens to them, but certainly the other private universities like mine are paying close attention.
Charles Klotfelter, thanks for joining us again. We always appreciate it when you can join the conversation.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Charles Klotfelter, he's a professor of economics and law at Duke University, and he's author of a book. It's called Big Time Sports in American Universities. Thanks so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.